All right, we're in Hebrews 6, and we are just exercising our muscles here. We're going to pick up at verse 17, and the point that the writer is making is that God made a promise to Abraham with an oath, and the problem with God, if I could say it this way, is that normally when you swear an oath, you swear by someone greater than yourself, but there isn't anybody greater than God, so God swears by himself. And that's the point that he makes, and then he explains that in verse 16, which we'll recap. He says, "For men swear," that's omniuzin, "according to a greater one," katatu meidzonos. And again, meidzon is the comparative of megas, which means big or great, right? "According to the greater one." And, now this was fun. In the next 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 words, there's no verb, of course. So you go all the way to the end, you get ha orkos, the oath. And then you have to figure out that peros is a noun that means end. It's neuter, singular, nominative, right? So the oath is an end. And then you go back to the beginning of all dispute, antilogias, for them, autois, unto certainty. And aren't you glad we did that last week, so we don't have to worry about it this week, right? And now, in relation to that, the writer to the Hebrews is going to make the direct point about the promise that God made to Abraham, and move from there, as we'll see fairly quickly, into the high priestly office of Christ in a way that you find nowhere else in the New Testament. We would barely have a doctrine of the high priestly office of Christ without the letter to the Hebrews. I mean, it's really quite remarkable. So verse 17, I'll read it first. En ho perisoteron boulamenos hatheos epidexai tois kleranamois tes epangelias. Ta ametathetan tes boules autu. Now here's the verb. Emesitusen orko. Horko. And we have a hina clause and a bunch of other stuff coming in verse 18, so we'll stop there. So enho, Blasterbrunner actually suggests that this is causal, because of which, or because this is the way things work with an oath, the writer says, God, now we have a predicate position participle from boulomai, which means to want or wish. So we'll do it woodenly at first. God, wishing epideixai, to show or to demonstrate, and perisoteron, you might conceivably recognize that as a comparative adjective. Perisos means abundant, and perisateros means more abundant. And, again, this is actually fairly common. If you parse this, you'd parse it as neuter singular accusative. And so it's acting like what part of speech? Anybody, neuter singular accusative adjectives often function as adverbs. More abundantly. Now, it's interesting. If you look, there's a flag on the play, as Dr. Bartelt likes to say. And if you look at the variant reading in verse 17, manuscript B, which is Vaticanus, actually turns it into an adverb, right? You see the teros, the omega sigma, is what we learn in elementary Greek, and of course a lot of Greek adverbs have that omega sigma ending. So because of which God, and we'll go ahead and take this predicate position participle causally. Because he wished to show more abundantly, tois kleronamois, this is just the noun for heir, to the heirs of the promise, tes epangelias. And what did he want to show? Ta ametathetan. Ametathetas is just an adjective, and it means unchangeable. Okay? So we just put an article on it, we turn it into a noun, right? So the unchangeable thing, or I suppose the translations probably take it as the unchangeable nature or something like that, tes boules autou, of his will. So because God wanted to show the unchangeable nature of his will, here's the verb, emesitousin horko. He mediated the promise by means of an oath, dative of means, right? So what we have is the subject, God. The verb is mediated. And all the rest of that before the verb, it goes with the participle, right? It's kind of a long participial construction, which functions as a dependent clause, probably with a causal sense. And then there's a purpose clause coming up in verse 18 that gives the purpose why God mediated the promise to Abraham by means of an oath. All right? Okay, that wasn't too bad. And the vocab, I suppose, wasn't as nasty as it's going to be. Questions about verse 17? Anything at all? It's actually really important, you know, when you're working with sentences like that, say, okay, now where's the main verb, right? And what are the clause equivalents? And so that theoretically, and I know this will cause some of you to break into hives, so that you can actually diagram the sentence, right? Because, as you know, Greek loves long sentences. So apparently God does, right? Right. So maybe we loved long sentences before Adam and Eve fell into sin. Right. Okay, questions? 17? All right, very good. Move on to 18. Now we have a henna clause, which as often, not always, but often expresses purpose, I think, here too. Henna dia dia pragmaton a metatheton. En hois adunatan psusasthai tantheon, ischiran paraklesen echomen, hoi kata fugantes kratesai tes prakemenes elpidas. Semicolon. Right? In order that, through two unchangeable matters. A pragma is a matter or a deed or a reality or something like that. In order that through two unchangeable matters or realities, in which, or maybe because of which, or in relationship to which, now we have the little adjective adunatan, impossible, and no verb. And one of the things you got to get used to is looking. Okay, you need to smell a linking verb clause, right? And you've got an adjective here, and then an infinitive, and you're supposed to say, "Oh, there's an implied linking verb here," right? And the infinitive is the subject. God to lie is impossible. And in English, we would supply what grammarians call a dummy subject. We would say what? It is impossible for God to lie. Right? So the whole point here is that God in his nature is, you know, reliable. And then when he makes a promise and swears by himself, that's like the second reason to think that God is not going to break his promise or something like that. So in order that, and we still haven't actually gotten to the verb of the henna clause, where who can tell me what the verb is? It's in the next line. It's fairly easy to spot. Anybody? Right. Echomen. The subjunctive of echo. Right. See the long connecting vowel. In order that through two reliable thingies, we might have. And now we're praying for an accusative. Oh, there it is, right in front of the verb. Strong consolation. Strong encouragement. Paraklesis can be translated different ways. I think here is more of a gospel word. We might have strong encouragement. Now, who are we? Let's define that more. Hoi kata fugantes kratesai. Tes prakemenes elpedes. So we, the ones who have fled for refuge. Kata fugo means to flee, especially to flee for refuge. Okay. And you flee for refuge, presumably, to do something. that is to krateo, that is to seize. And yes, unhappily, krateo can take both an accusative object or a genitive direct object. And that makes tes pra kemenes elpidos, the direct object of the infinitive kratesi. Pra kemai means to, well, among other things, it means to lie in front of or to be in front of. This is actually the same term in Hebrews 12. Run the race, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, and so forth. That's the same, to set something in front of someone. So the subject of the verb, ekomen, then, is we who, the ones who have fled in order to seize the lying before hope, which I'm very happy to point out is an eschatological reference. And now I got to say eschatological, so I feel better. Right. So this is why God mediated with an oath, in order that we might have strong encouragement. That would be the basic structure of the henna clause. Okay? Again, if you can do that, if you can put, first of all, you put all the pieces together, then by the time you get to the end of the verse, you can't remember what the word meant at the beginning of the verse, right? So if you can put it all together, and then if you can, you strip it away, and you can see the clause in its most basic form, verb, direct object, subject, and then you can kind of put the pieces back on the various parts of the clause, and it can make sense. So this is why God swore with an oath, in order that we might have strong encouragement. Right? Because God doesn't lie, especially once he swears. In fact, the hope is so firm that it's like an anchor, which we're about to see in verse 19. Questions about verse 18? Tim?
Well, this might say where you don't want to go, but would you put a lot of force on that, the fleeing ones, namely, that conjures up a whole picture of fleeing from what, or a certain kind of character that a person has?
Oh, okay.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Right. Should we put that much force on
fleeing? Well, the question is, how much force should we put, and how much does it say about the subject if you're fleeing for refuge? You know, I was looking at my notes from earlier years working on this text, and you know Charlie Hendrickson. He actually suggested a parallel to the image of fleeing to take hold of the horns of the altar. You know, and there is a parallel, actually. I wrote it down long ago. 1 Kings 2:28, which apparently is a fairly close parallel. So I do actually think that, you know, it does say that the people who are fleeing are those who cannot defend themselves, who cannot save themselves, and so they're fleeing for refuge to the promise that God has given. So at least that much. It is. Exactly. Yeah. Right. On the one hand, you're supposed to stand firm. On the other hand, you're supposed to run away. Yeah, yeah. Which sounds like Monty Python, doesn't it? Run away, run away. Right? Yeah. So, yeah, no, I think it's a fair question, and I think it's at least that much. So, for instance, you know, this, and I think people, the only people who think romantically about persecution are those who have never gone through it. So you hear, for instance, you hear these things, you hear people say this all the time. I think the church really needs some good persecution. It'll make the church stronger. You know, that is a really stupid thing to say. In persecution, a lot of people lose their faith and they die and go to hell. A lot do. Right? I'm not saying that God can't work through persecution. He can. And he does, and he has. But, you know, Jesus tells the 12, now it's a specific text, he says, when they persecute you in this city, he doesn't say stand firm and die. He says, run away. He says, flee to the next, you know. And when Peter was arrested in Acts 12, the angel, remember that funny story where the angel wakes him up and kicks him in the side? And Peter doesn't think it's real. And the angel tells Peter, get the heck out of town. See? So it's not always the case that Christians are to, like, who's the guy that wanted to be oven-baked in the, you know, the martyr, was it Polycarp, I think? Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I'm not criticizing St. Polycarp, but if you've never read it, it can come off at least as a little weird. Right? So, but he had already been arrested, and that's a little different. So don't volunteer for martyrdom. in other words. To which you're thinking, well, why the heck did I come to seminary then? Why am I here at Greek Club? Good. Questions about verse 18? Yeah, Tim.
What, when it said at the beginning, through to, you said unchangeable matters?
Yeah, something like that.
What's it referring to?
I think it's referring to the fact that God is reliable in himself and that he made a promise.
Oh, okay.
And swore an oath. I think that's what it is. But to be honest, I'm not quite sure. I thought about that about 11:45. I thought, man, if I had another half hour, I could really figure that one out. But I think that's what it is. The writer to the Hebrews, Paul is like this sometimes. He really invites you to follow a lengthy argument. And we're about to get into that, actually. We'll lose our place once we get deep into chapter 7. What are we talking about again? It's really interesting and quite unique in some ways. So that would be my somewhat informed guess. So, yeah, do you want to work up like a 2-page paper on that? Or? Yeah, okay. Maybe next week.
Yeah,
so,
next week.
Yeah, okay, good. Okay. Great. Okay, let's take up verse 19. Start with a relative pronoun, hain, right? Hain hos ankeron. Ha, yes, it means anchor. Isn't that great? Echaman tes psikes asphaleta kai bebayan kai eis erchamenein eis ta esoteron tu kata patasmatas, which is fun to say. Hapu, we'll go ahead and finish verse 20. Hapu prodamas hyperhemon eis elthen Iesus, katatein toxin melchisedek, archiereus genomenos eis ton iona. So that's good. You have at least two words that you know what it means. Ankeron, which means anchor, and Melchizedek, which means Aaron. Yeah, no, that's a little joke. So, okay, now the hain, the relative pronoun at the beginning is feminine singular accusative, right? And it could refer all the way back to paraklesin, consolation. Most people, I think, take it to refer to hope, which is also feminine singular. Remember that a relative pronoun will agree with its antecedent in gender and number, but not necessarily case. The case of the relative pronoun is determined by how it's functioning in its own clause. And here, the hain is accusative, actually, because it's the direct object of echamen, which we have, right? So we have which. It's the direct object of echamen. So the hope lying before us, which hope we have as an anchor of life, or of our life. Now, beware, this is kind of a general comment, beware of translating psyche as soul, right? It rarely in the New Testament means soul as opposed to body. Most of the time it means self, person, life, and, you know, in every full sense of the phrase, as in the Son of Man came to give his psyche as a ransom payment. Jesus didn't just give his soul, but not his body, right? So here, the anchor of our life is the hope that is lying before us, right? And let's modify anchor now by just stringing some accusative adjectives in a series, okay? What kind of an anchor? Certain, asphale. The way you might remember that root is that this is the it's related to the noun in the Lucan prologue that he writes so that Theophilus might have certainty, asphaleia. Okay, so that might be a place where you'd encounter the noun form. This is the adjective, which we have as a certain, and now we've got asphale te kai adjective kai verbal adjective, right? The te is post-positive, so to translate, you put in your head, you put it in front of asphale, okay? So what kind of an anchor? A certain and firm and, do you hear the sound of the metaphor shifting? We're moving from anchor to sanctuary language, right? So an anchor which is certain and firm and entering into the inner region of the curtain. I mean, without warning, you shift to the image of the tabernacle, right? And the Holy of Holies. It's a very unexpected move. he just does it. And eis erkamen on there is just it's a participle, so it's a verbal adjective, and we'd take it as attributive position, even though there's no article anywhere. And it's modifying anchor. What kind of an anchor? An entering into the insider, esoteron, inner place, supply place, of the curtain. A kata petasma is the curtain, and here it's taken to be the veil, which separates, as you'll recall, the holy place from the holiest place. Right? So you got the two-thirds of the temple, which is, as you remember, not that big of a building, right? Most of our churches are way bigger than the temple proper. And then there's this curtain that separates the holy place from the Holy of Holies, as we say in a literal Hebrew sort of rendering, right? And what happened in that inner place, verse 20, and then we can kind of clarify and try to answer any questions. Where a prodromos, this is a literally forerunner. Okay, that's what it looks like, and that's what it means. A dromos is a runner, right? By the way, you can remember this one if you know what the word palindrome means. Anybody remember what a palindrome is? Yeah, it's letters in English or any language, I suppose, that read the same forwards and backwards. Like madam, I'm Adam, right? See? Does anybody know the longest palindrome in the history of the English language? I do. You ready for this? Go hang a salami, I'm a lasagna hog. It's Aaron, it's true. Aaron is looking at me in utter disbelief. He's like the disciples in the boat when Jesus stilled the storm. No, he's not afraid. He's just incredulous. So go hang a salami, I'm a lasagna hog. Where a forerunner on our behalf, eis elthen. Yes, an aorist indicative active, third singular. Entered, right, from eis erkamai. And who might that prodromos be? Jesus. Jesus. And now we're going to talk about Jesus and modify him leading up to chapter 7. According to the toxis, the order of Melchizedek, a chief priest having become forever. Right? And so we've got the participle genomenos from our friend genomai, aorist participle, middle deponent, masculine singular nominative. And we can take it, I think, easily enough. Its referent is Jesus, and we'll take it as attributive adjectival. You could take it temporal or causal as well. So it could go, Jesus, who has become a chief priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek, or Jesus, because he has become a chief priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. And the little prepositional phrase at the end, you may have seen this in the New Testament. It's relatively common. An ion is just an age, right? And so into the age. So this is le'olam, right, Tim, in Hebrew? Yeah, it's the equivalent. So let's do 19 and 20 together, and then we got maybe just a second for questions or observations. So the line, the set before you hope, which we have as an anchor of our life, a certain and firm, and entering into the inner place of the curtain anchor, where, the inner place, a forerunner on our behalf entered. The name, and by the way, who goes into the holiest place? The high priest and the high priest only. But this high priest is not according to the order of Aaron. He's according to the order of Melchizedek. And because that's the case, as the argument will continue to run, his high priestly office and his high priestly sacrifice is superior to that of Aaron. That's the argument. Yeah, nice eyebrows, Jay. I appreciate that. Huh. It does fit together. Yeah, it does, but you got to take deep breaths in Hebrews. You really do. Questions about 18 and or 19 and 20? Well, we have the hope, and it's like an anchor. Isn't that weird? Yeah, it's like an anchor. What kind of it's a certain anchor. It's a firm anchor, and then metaphor shift alert. Now all of a sudden it's an enter into the inner place anchor, right?
Yeah.
So, no, I mean, we have a kind of a strange mixing of it's not metaphors, but of images here. I don't know what else to do with it. So, except believe it. Good. Other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Greek Club.